Hi everyone, and welcome to Press X, the Geek Show's dedicated video games podcast. We have a plethora of video games to talk about today. Like that word, plethora. My name's Rob, and joining me today are the statuesque Mick.
Hello.
The beautiful Mark.
Hello.
And the picturesque Rob.
Why am I picturesque? I'm not a landscape poet.
I want to know why Mark hasn't got an adjective ending in esque.
Well, I was thinking, what can I say? What can I say? What else ends in esque? I want Rob to be picturesque. What else ends in esque?
And Mark,
burlesque.
The burlesque Mark.
I went a bit artsy, so I think we're going to go on mix there. Because I don't know how a person can be Dada-esque, but there you go.
I'm not entirely sure how a person can be burlesque, but there you go.
I think that a Dada reference might be the most pretentious reference ever made in any video game podcast anywhere in the world.
So, yeah, how are you guys doing this week?
Hi, not bad. Not bad.
Yeah, not too distressed this week.
I know this is silly to say, so seeing as though one of the recent recordings of Four Panel was partly in Arab Emirates. But
no, holy.
Yeah, well, part of the cast.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's nice that the weather isn't melting my flesh. That's always nice. I know the Arab Emirates is a bit hotter than the northeast of England.
A bit. Yeah. A bit is an understatement, isn't it?
Yeah. When we did that episode, Andrew and Rob were complaining that it was like in the mid-20s. And I explained that over in the Emirates we called that aircon.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Wasn't it one of your mates said the aircon over there was the same temperature as his heating over here?
Yeah.
Well, if I went alert, I would die, probably.
Well, you'd be surprised, Rob, because you'd spend all your time, like I did, wandering around merchandise shops in malls that are all air-conditioned. They have ice rinks in their malls.
I don't mean it in the way that this might come off, but I'm a bit like a dog.
Hold on, exactly in what way did you think that was going to come out?
Well, in a lot of odd ways. But when it's hot, I just need like a cool corner and I'll sort of just melt a bit.
And
I need like a little bowl of water and I'll be cool. I'll be fine.
I am not letting you sit on my carpet anymore.
Why does he molt?
Just in case he starts dragging himself all over it.
My secret's out. Damn.
Please don't leave any Robs in cars.
Yeah, we don't like it when in hot cars. Robs die in hot cars.
Yeah, or at least wind the window down a little bit.
Right, anyhow, it was video games after that, and I apologise for that. Yeah, let's move on. The first game, let me put it in the plainest possible terms. It's possibly the most generic title for any video game ever. That's harsh, I know, but it is called First Strike Final Hour.
I was worried you'd forgotten the title again for a second there.
Well, that's the problem, you know, when it's a title which is kind of nondescript, it's kind of hard to remember.
It does seem to have taken an element of all the best-selling franchises ever made.
It's the title you'd see on one of those novels that you only read on holiday.
Yeah.
It sounds like two different versions of Command & Conquer DLC packs.
Yeah, it's the game of the year edition, isn't it?
What, Command and Conquer First Strike Final Hour Game of the Year edition? Yeah. Actually, yeah, that does sound pretty good. But what it is it was initially a mobile game, and it shows, unfortunately. But before I get into that, what it actually is a sort of end of the world game where everything's gone to pot and all nations are sort of declaring war on each other. And there's like nuclear bombs as part of your arsenal. You've got to research in a way that you would with a sort of a town development game that you get on your phone or on Facebook or something like that, where you develop in those games. Align yourselves with like neighbouring countries and just blow everybody out of the water, really. So yeah, it's an end of the world simulator. I say simulator. Well, yeah, I think we're living through the end of the world now. But anyway, political ramblings aside, yeah, it explains the title First Strike Final Hour because, you know, it's the final hour of the Earth and it's about, you know, military dominance. So the First Strike also makes sense. its art style is quite, it's lots of blues and blacks, and it's quite sci-fi and stylistic. It looks nice. You know, it looks especially nice on a mobile phone, it has to be said. Like a tablet or a mobile phone, I think it'd look great. And it'd also play great. But when you pull it on like a PC and you change the screen drag mechanic, which is perfectly fine as a mechanic, and you turn that into click and drag.
Oh, that's not clever.
Well, you'd think it'd be a nice translation, but it's weird how, you know, there's always been talk of like the PC Master Race, because how could you work with like a controller? Controllers are rubbish. It's got to be keyboard and mouse. But in the case of this, keyboard and mouse is like a poor version of mobile phone apps.
It would have been better just to have like, is it like a global map layout?
Well, it's just like a little globe, and you sort of drag the world around into where you want. And it's quite awkwardly signposted, because you don't really know where you are or who you are or how. There's no quick keys to get where you need to be or what you need to do. So it's quite an awkward experience, really.
Would you say, Rob, that it'd work better on a laptop that had the touchscreen interface?
Yes, it would, actually. Yeah. I know that's like a growing thing, but this is, I did it on like a normal pleb computer.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think that's the problem, you know. It's not new by any stretch. There's been countless games where they've said, oh, right, we've got consoles, we've got handheld games, we've got PC, we've got every console under the sun. I should put it on all of them. There's countless examples of games like that. And I think it has to have like a certain level of depth to a game to be a successful port across all the consoles and all formats. When it starts off as a PC, not as a mobile game. And those mobile games are basically when you're in the toilet or when you're on the train or whatever.
On the train.
I don't like the idea of pooping where people, you know, just, you know, minding their own business within like a foot of me.
If that ever happens to me, I just go, and tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be.
Yes. But the point is, if you're going to port it across, it has to be there's something to it. And I think it's a very basic game. And when you port it across the PC, I think it needs a bit more substance, which is totally lacking, I think. But I'd love to play it on a phone. I'd love to play it there. I think it'd work wonders. Not on PC. I can't remember the name of that game, which is on literally everything. Terra something, what was it?
Oh, Terranigma, was it? Terraria.
Yeah, that was literally on everything.
Oh, Terraria, yeah.
And that worked because it had something to it. But, yeah, just because that worked doesn't mean everything can work. So, yeah, First Strike, Final Hour, most generic title in the universe. Play it on your tablet or your piece on your phone.
I've got one question. Is that the one that Arnie's promoting?
No.
More. I don't know, like Commando, isn't it? Sort of earthly.
That's definitely more of a Commando, Command and Conquer type clone, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh,
this is sort of like more concerned with like satellites and sort of out in the space. The perspective of the game is out in space.
It does have the word strike in it. It's called Mobile Strike, that one that Arnie promotes.
That's probably why I'm getting it mixed up. It's another war game with the word strike in it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think the people who name these games are the same people who write headlines for The Sun?
I'd say more Daily Mail than Sun. But
because they've managed to string four words together in that title.
Yeah. which
indicates that they know four words.
The thing that's a shame is I think you might have enjoyed it a bit more if you could flatten the map.
You would, because you get a better sense of scale and place.
Yeah, but having just the globe mechanic on just a normal PC... Well, that doesn't have a touchscreen. You know, if you had like an option just to use a flat map on it, then that might have solved the problem.
If it was like built like a civilization style game.
Yeah.
Like a warmongering civilization style game, the way the map works there, I think it'd be great. But it doesn't, it's just like a little circle in the middle of the screen which you sort of fiddle around and twist and move.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. Moving on to me then.
Yeah. Awkward transition from outer space to Japan.
Well, no, it's not Japan. Well,
you can see Japan from outer space, so there you go. Yeah, there's a link.
See Japan from outer space. And,
oh, effortlessly done.
Yeah, and two of the new characters are based on Japanese warrior classes, I suppose you'd call them. One of them is a ninja who apparently is a businessman as well and has like a magic mobile phone. His name is Answer. And
what's a magic mobile phone?
It's like this glowy thing on his ear. It looks like a magic circle around his ear.
And so it's Bluetooth.
And he seems to have a briefcase as well. I'm not sure why. But he's definitely a ninja because he's wearing a mask and he does ninja-like moves. And the other person is a samurai, a female samurai with an eye patch over her right eye and showing off her massive cleavage called Baikal. So they're the two new additions to this video game franchise. And that's right, all those fans of fighting games out there, I am talking about Guilty Gear Xrd Rev 2.
I think they've got the same person who names games as well.
Yeah. Now, we have already talked about the original Xrd Revelator game. And if you want to know about that, go to our YouTube channel and have a watch of Lewis's review of that. He is very much into his fighting games, so if you are into your technicalities with fighting games, that's the review to watch. Me, I'm a button masher. And so I'm approaching this game from a totally different perspective. And you know what? It's pretty good, I've got to say.
Tekken players must hate you.
Well, all fighting game players hate button mashers.
No, but Tekken's like the king. You can be really good at that game just by button mashing.
Oh, no. The difference is, I actually know quite a few moves in Tekken just from having played Tekken for so long. So in the middle of button mashing, I'll probably string a 10-move combo together and have the other person going, I thought you were a button masher.
Sly.
Yeah. Sneaky, just like a ninja. Guilty Gear Xrd Rev 2 isn't actually a full game, right? Arc System Works have done a thing where if you have the original Guilty Gear Xrd Revelator, you can just pay half the price and upgrade the game to Rev 2. Or you can buy the full game. The full game costs you like $40, 35 quid, whatever. And the half version costs $20, 17 quid, whatever. And it's as colourful as the original Revelator game. The graphics are superb. I've got to say, not too hot on the cell shading of it, but generally everything looks really, really, really pretty. And it's got a great tutorial mode, because if you're like me and you're a button masher, the tutorial actually helps you a lot, because it teaches you how to do very specific things that most button mashers, when you put them in front of a game, they'll just go, and then you'll end up with a broken joystick or broken thumbs. But the tutorial in this is very, very good. The game itself is a lot of fun to play. Now, it's got two combat modes when you play the game. You can have technical or stylish. And technical is what the more advanced fighting game players would use, because they want the intricate nature of, you know, of the controls. They want to fight using those. But if you're like me and you just want to mash buttons and pull off, you know, stylish moves, then go for the stylish option, because it simplifies all the controls. You still have the same base control set, but it just makes pulling off all of those special moves a lot easier. And I think that's one of the nice things about the Guilty Gear series, is that they actually have that option. So you could be a button masher taking on somebody who plays technically, and it'd be a fairly even match.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not saying you'd definitely win, because, you know, these people play this as kind of their bread and butter. But yeah.
Do they have an option for people who play of beating ups like Hulk Smash?
No.
That's how I kind of work it.
But this is the thing, right? The two new characters, I played through several characters on this, and it's got a story mode, it's got your arcade mode, it's got your online mode. They really push the online mode as much as they can. And if you are a complete novice at fighting games, do not go for the online mode, because it will crush your spirit. Because everybody who goes to the online mode has been playing it for a while, and they are much, much better than you, or me in this case. I won't say that online mode crushed my spirit. I won't say that, you know, that it left like deep, deep trauma. And that
did it make you humble?
No, it didn't make me humble at all. I'm still proud.
Okay. So like, Iron Sheik didn't turn up and put you in a camel clutch and say, I make you humble.
No, he didn't. Thank God for that. But yeah, the online mode, they really push that. But there are a couple of little modes that are actually quite interesting. There is a story mode, Xrd Rev 2. They've got like an episode mode, which is set like the day before the main storyline. But they've got all sorts of other things. They have like a little fishing mini game where you, as you go through the game, you'll gather coins and stuff like that, and you can then buy turns on this fishing thing, which will give you like loads of little prizes, and you can upgrade your little avatar and the fishing bit and stuff like that. There's a lot of stuff to do, which is surprising for a fighting game. Do you remember when Tekken came out with Tekken Bowling, and then you had like that side-scrolling fighting game that was included as part of one of the Tekken games as well? I think it was Tekken 5 that was in, something like that, Tekken 4 or 5. So you had like other games to play in with this main fighting game. This is a bit like that, where you have lots of other little things to do that kind of add to the experience of the fighting game. And yeah,
it's weird how fishing is a very common thing like that.
Yeah, I think
I've played more fishing in video games than I ever will in real life.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
It seems to be a popular thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but here's the thing. How many of those games that you played fishing in were Japanese?
Yeah, and how many of them were Sega Bass Fishing? Because Sega Bass Fishing is the best fishing.
Oh, Sega did one that was better than bass fishing.
What, Seaman?
No.
That's a real game, but don't Google search it because you're on sketchy territory there.
No, I know. I own that game. it is an actual game. It's not just you open the box and there's a picture of the old Arsenal goalkeeper. But yeah.
Oh, I forgot about him.
Oh, good recovery, Rob. Good recovery.
But yeah, Guilty Gear Xrd Rev 2. It's a fun game. And if you're a novice to fighting games, yeah, some people might recommend you play BlazBlue or something like that. But I'll be honest, having played BlazBlue, I think if I was going to take up fighting games on a regular basis, Guilty Gear is one of the ones I choose over and above BlazBlue.
Well, they're not exactly welcoming any fighting game to a newbie either.
This one actually is a lot more welcoming to a newbie than most of the fighting games are, as long as you stay away from online mode.
Because online mode make you humble.
Oh, it make you humble long time.
Oh, don't ruin that.
It's good that they are trying to do that with fighting games, because, I mean, we spoke about this last week, about, like, ARMS and a few other series where the art actually seemed to be trying to get newcomers into the genre, because I would say out of all the genres, that is probably the most difficult one to get into.
Yeah, that's a
there's a sort of preconception that everybody understands combos and tactics involved in fighting and when to save up your special abilities and all the rest of it, and that's just not the case.
Whereas you're right, because for most of us, they're like, oh, I've built up this gauge. How do I activate that big thing that I can do? How do I do that?
Yeah,
I mean, I know you don't like it, Rob, but that's fundamentally why Smash Brothers is so popular.
No, I know that's why Smash Brothers is so popular. It's not that I don't like Smash Brothers. I just don't like the fact that they keep making the same game over and over again and then claiming that that they're being different every single year, and then criticizing FIFA for being the same game every single year, and yet they'll play Smash Brothers every single year. The hypocrisy is what I don't like.
Yeah, yeah. I get you. But for, like, shooters I get are like that as well.
Yeah.
And as bad as they are, I don't think any of them are as bad as what's it called? Brain fart.
Overwatch,
yeah. Overwatch is really bad for that now.
Yeah, I don't like the fact that you're apparently not a gamer if you don't play Overwatch.
Who said that?
That was the thing that was going around for a while, wasn't it? When Overwatch came out?
Yeah, I go online to play Battleborne with my sons occasionally, and we get people coming on online in the lobbies who come online to play Battleborn just so that they can tell us we shouldn't be playing Battleborn, we should be playing Overwatch.
See?
That's not cool, that.
I know.
What a great use of time.
Yeah.
Indeed. Our response is always, well, if Overwatch is so great, why are you on Battleborn?
I'm pro-choice. I'm using that reference right, aren't I?
I don't know.
Yes, Rob, of course you are.
Who's next?
Well, I'm going to take this one, and while we're on the discussion of games that haven't advanced for so long, I've been playing Yooka-Laylee, so let's take our little time-traveling toilets or TARDISes or underwear or whatever we've got to do to go about in the future.
Who's got time traveling underwear?
Have you not got yours?
No.
Yeah, time traveling underpants. You can get them. I think three pairs for a fiver from Primark.
Jesus, I'm still
Primark
waiting.
Does everything.
I'm still waiting for that Muslimic ray gun I ordered years ago.
Yes, our ukulele at EGX last year. They had like a massive display. They were making quite a big deal out of it. It was very popular as well.
Yeah, it was very popular. I was really hyped for it. I backed the Kickstarter for it years ago. And because I picked Wii U, I still don't actually have my Kickstarter backing because they changed it to Switch and didn't release it on the Switch. So yeah, this is the PS4 version. And ukulele is essentially Banjo-Kazooie 3. So I'm sure most people will have heard of Banjo-Kazooie. If not, get your time-traveling underwear and go back 20 years. And
well, I don't know, because some people might say, well, I've heard of a banjo and I've heard of a kazoo.
But the thing is, like, it's kind of like the unsung hero of the N64, Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah.
It was basically the most beloved 3D platformer of the time.
Yeah, way more than Super Mario 64 was.
Yeah, well, Mario 64 came first, and then Banjo-Kazooie kind of took everything that Mario 64 did and improved on it. And then Spyro the Dragon came out, and all of the kids were like, ah, this is cool, I've never played a game like this. And everyone just kind of looked at Mario and then Spyro, and then were like, yeah, we'll ignore you, Banjo.
And somewhere in the middle of that, Crash Bandicoot was just off to the side gyrating.
We'll get to him in a minute.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, Banjo and Kazooie, it was probably about 20 years ago this year that came out, and it was a 3D platformer which kind of had, I wouldn't say huge, it had open worlds, but all these open worlds are contained in, like, little segments. So there was, like, a wooded area where you could go and just explore this and collect jigsaws and notes, and then there was a boat level, and there was a haunted mansion, and there was an advent calendar one, and there was a swamp, and there was all your usual staples of gaming platform and worlds where you could just go in, you could explore them, and you could just collect jigsaws and attack monsters and stuff like that. For the time, it was still pretty ahead of its game. I mean, obviously, we only had really hard Mario that you could really compare it to, and Bubsy 3D, which I don't know why I brought that up.
Nobody talks about Bubsy.
I liked it as a kid, but I think it's best to leave it there.
I'm sorry, but you are not allowed to say anything bad about Bubsy. You know, he can't take any more of this depression, this pain.
So, yeah, moving on 20 years, and we have ukulele, and it is literally Banjo-Kazooie. There's not as many worlds as, like, five worlds, but when you're playing it, you're kind of just sitting there playing it, and it's just like, yeah, they really are trying to be Banjo-Kazooie. The music is like the same artists who did stuff for Banjo-Kazooie. They've got a few of the developers. They've even got the same weird grunting noises when the characters talk. But it's Banjo-Kazooie, but it's not Banjo-Kazooie. I went back to play Banjo-Kazooie and thought, oh, maybe this is just my nostalgia talking for the game. But that still plays really well. There's a lot of stuff in this game that, as a game that's 20 years on from Banjo-Kazooie, it all feels very much the same.
See, here's the thing. When I first saw the trailer for Ukulele, mm-hmm. I thought, I recognise this game from somewhere.
Yeah, it's literally, they just kind of took Banjo and Kazooie, skin-swapped them because of legal reasons, and Rare don't seem to want to do anything with Banjo-Kazooie productively, and they kind of just went with it. I mean, it's the way they've advertised it, oh, it's a love letter to all those 3D platformers, and it's like, oh yeah, we've got all of these people who've done it, and it's like, yeah, this isn't a bad game, but in 20 years, surely gaming has advanced.
Well,
but
yeah.
This very much hasn't.
Well, yeah, because I mean, the one that springs to mind is kind of an obvious alternative to Ukulele is Rayman.
Yeah.
Because Rayman kind of went the other way. This is basically like a 3D roaming around platformer, but Rayman went from 3D roaming around platformer to 2D platformer. And never look back, did it?
Exactly.
Hmm.
I mean, there's Crash Bandicoot there, who's went from being a 2D platformer to a 3D platformer, and then kind of just re-released the same games again. Well, it's kind of... Like I said, this is not a bad game. There is some issues with loading. I don't know why a game 20 years later takes a lot longer to load screens than Banjo-Kazooie does on the N64. But, yeah, I just don't understand why... It's not that I don't understand why this exists. I understand that they wanted to go for the Banjo-Kazooie crowd. I just don't understand why they haven't improved on anything. And it's a bit of a shame. It just feels like a little bit of a wasted opportunity.
Fair point.
It is a pity. It's a thing which has been present in games, now movies even, for a long time now. It's they're using like the style of a certain time to make movies in the modern day. You sort of look at this, it used to happen, isn't it all nostalgic and cool?
Yeah.
And with stuff like this, it seems to be getting its head into games as well. And I'm not sure I like that.
I think one of the arguments you could have for that nostalgic aspect of games is back in the old, and I'm going to wear my really big time traveling underpants now, but back in the old 8-bit days, you know, the games had gameplay because they had to. There was no technological advance that they could leverage to make it look fantastic or sound fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, if you tried to put speech in, it sounded like a goose farted in the fog.
I played some games like that.
Well, I put in a previous episode of Press X, I played the Disney collection of I can't even remember the name of the characters now. But
it was DuckTales 1 and 2, Rescue Rangers, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I can't remember. Tailspin, was it?
Yeah, but those games were hard.
Yeah.
And it's funny what the pick to be nostalgic about.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the issues with this game. It's like they've based all the characters, they're trying to do it similar to Banjo-Kazooie, but whereas Banjo-Kazooie kind of had like a lot of stuff where it kind of made sense in the Banjo-Kazooie world, like for example, in the swamp area, you had like giant weird turtles and frogs that were a bit dodgy and stuff like that. This is kind of just like, oh, look, it's a snake wearing trousers. Oh, we'll call him Trouser Snake.
Oh, really?
There's a fridge, and we'll call, I can't remember what the fridge is called, but it's like, we'll call her like Freezy Girl and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, look, there's Shovel Knight. Because Shovel Knight's popular. And it's kind of like, it's kind of chicken and it's just going, look, you like Banjo-Kazooie. This is just like Banjo-Kazooie, only there's more of it. And it's just kind of like, yeah, you know, why don't you just play Banjo-Kazooie?
You know what this kind of reminds me of? You know when you had like these really big zeitgeisty platformers and other companies went, ooh, that's cool, let's do that, but completely change everything, but just leave enough there to know that we ripped it off.
Yeah.
The 90s was littered with that crap.
Well, there was also the fact that certainly in the late 80s and early 90s, a lot of those platform games became like iconic to a particular platform. So you had Sega with Sonic, Mario for Nintendo, and on the Amiga you had Zool. But take away the actual variations of character, and they were effectively the same game.
Yeah.
Just a slightly different mechanic. So it was, they were there to build up a brand loyalty. So you became a Zool fan because you had an Amiga.
Yeah.
You didn't, you know, if your mate was a Sonic fan, it was because he had a Sega. And you never saw a Sonic game appear on the other platforms, and you never saw a Mario game appear on the other platforms. But now there's a sort of generic element that you do see some of those people appear on other platforms. I know there's been Mario games for Xbox 360.
Sonic and Mario went to the Olympics together, remember?
Yeah.
Sounds like a book, a dating book, that.
Sonic and Mario sitting in a tree.
Well, the modern progressive people. I think Mario and Sonic can see who they want to.
Yes. But yeah, so there wasn't the cross-pollination across platforms of these iconic, like sort of corporate logos almost.
Yeah. I mean, the cross pollination that you have
now, it's a bit more generic.
Yeah. You did get some cross pollination, but it was mainly like movie tie-ins and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like the Terminator 2 Judgment Day video game was on several platforms.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. That the sort of the iconic video game characters like Mario.
Oh no, they didn't.
They were brand logos.
And I'll be honest, I preferred Zool to Sonic and Mario.
He had a cool design.
Well, he's a ninja from the nth dimension.
I don't even know what that means.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
but just roll the phrase around your tongue a little. It's much better than Blue Hedgehog.
Who runs fast and says, gotta go fast. Or an Italian plumber stuck in La La Land.
Yeah.
Or Hollywood, as we now know it's known.
Chasing the dragon.
I wonder if the Japanese Mario is as racist as the American one. I'm pretty sure Italian people don't go, it's a me, Mario. No. I'm pretty sure they're not talking about that.
Only if their first name is Mario.
All I know that is that he's got a real turtle problem.
I'm going to sort of try and... It's a pity that, though, of ukulele, because it did look really interesting, but... Going back to EGX.
It's not a bad game. It's not. While we have ragged on it, it's not a bad game. It's just kind of like, because Banjo and Kazooie was so good, this has just kind of stayed at that point, and it's just kind of like, it's not bad. It's just the same.
I think it was around the same area in EGX, if memory serves. But there was another game from Rare Alumni called Snake Pass.
Yeah.
Had a very similar style, sort of mid-90s animal platformer.
Yeah, I've got that on the Switch, and that one's fun, but we'll do that for another day.
It's a challenge, we'll say. But at least it's doing something new. I think that's the takeaway from that one. I've also been playing Memorandum. Is that right? Memoranda. And that is from, that's out on Steam, on Steam boxes. No, that's not a thing. From Bitbiters, the company's called, who put it together. And again, I'm going to put in another odd reference for a video game show here. It's inspired by one of my favourite authors, Haruki Murakami. I read Hard Boy, Wonderland and the End of the World. It's probably my favourite book. So recommend. But it's taken the spirit of his stories, and it's putting it into an entirely original adventure point-and-click game in which you play a young girl called Mizuki. And even though she's called Mizuki, she's forgot her name. And because she's forgot her name, she can't really get on with life. And the way that Murakami's stories kind of work is they're very much based in reality, but they kind of have like a woozy, off-kilter nature about them, which just is enough to sort of separate them from normality. Like, it puts itself in its own little corner, I think. And it's hard to sort of separate my experience with point-and-click games is, well, they're much of a muchness. They play exactly as the genre says they're play, you know. It's point-and-click. I think that's why a lot of people have really got behind the Telltale stuff, because it's a bit of a evolution of the point-and-click.
Mm-hmm.
Because you physically move your character around via the sticker or whatever. You don't have to point there, go there. So it's new and fresh. But this is very much inside of the old world. Well, not old world. The old style of it. So like Broken Sword and titles like that and Escape from Monkey Island and stuff like that. So there is that. But the art style is weird because they kind of look like puppets, maybe. I think that might be just like the sort of the crude animation. Because the lead character, Mizuki again, she walks like she's got sort of long poles down her leg because she can't actually bend at the knee. So it's an odd presentational thing. And it also has these weird, worldly, weirdy things. Because there's a character early on in it, as you go to this one puzzle where you got to go to this man's house who's got some old videos. So to get those old videos, you set up like a film night in your house, your flat, your block of flat. And when you get to that house, outside it is a man only you can see who won't disappear until you go to sleep. Like he's like a mental manifestation or something. He's just like this madman with a beard sat in the front outside of this house. And when you get into the house, this is the sort of the nature of it. It's like three rooms, like the foyer, there's a little room on the side with like a thing of puppets in and a corridor which leads to where the house owner is. And the house owner says, if you solve the puzzles in my house and prove your intellect, I will show you on my TV film from, well, TV from 100 years ago, even though obviously TV from 100 years ago wasn't a thing. Not in the way, I think this is sort of like a 80s, it has a sort of feel. Not like when things say they're from the 80s, they tell you they're from the 80s. You know, they scream it loud and proud. This is, I think this is more 80s in the sort of subtle facts, whereas everything's a bit rubbish and simple.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a weird world thing to it, which is really refreshing. But for me, it always comes back to sort of the way these games play. In the introduce item A to item B and solve the puzzle. Because there's some really legendary things, you know, that make no sense whatsoever. I mean, Broken Sword is pretty famous for just, I don't know, like odd puzzles where you introduce, like, I don't know, a baguette into a puzzle and it solves it for some reason.
Monkey Island and its rubber chickens.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird logic. It's the weird logic of all these puzzles because it makes it difficult, you know. I mean, you got like a vague idea of where you want to go. But when you get there, it presents like a scaling like path of puzzles. I mean, you know, they start easy and they get harder. But when they get hard, it's just, as a genre, it's just so abstract, you don't know what the hell you're supposed to do. And as much as I like the style of games, I think, and as much as I like Haruki Murakami and the sort of the woozy fantasy style it has, I think it all comes down to the fact that it's a point and click and it's just kind of weird. And it's kind of weird to get your head around some of the abstract ideas and puzzles that they put forward.
Is it more abstract and weird than, say, Monkey Island?
Well, no, but the thing is, I don't think the point and click is it's getting a little bit of a resurgence, especially on Steam with titles like Thimbleweed Park and Oxenfree and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's still super niche. And you can't just go into a point and click. You got to be in the point and click mentality. You got to be in the point and click like frame of mind. And I don't think there's any other genre that's really like that. No, not really. Because, yeah, everything's fine and dandy. But when you get to a point and click, they're like their own little obtuse corner in there, away from everybody. So it's not a criticism of the game. It's just you kind of have to warm up for it. But it really doesn't want to let you warm up because it has to have like puzzles and it has to have a sense of difficulty to it. Does that make sense?
I just
wonder because obviously, like when I first started gaming, point and clicks were the future.
I remember those days, Mick.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember being amazed sitting there watching a ZX Spectrum spent 10 minutes drawing a hobbit hole, and that wasn't even point and click.
I remember those days as well.
Yeah. That wasn't even point and click, Rob. That was a text adventure that had some pictures.
I know. I had that game.
But point and click reached the pinnacle with the... I can't remember his name now. Rod Gilbert.
Yep.
I can't remember his name. The Gilbert no. stuff, which...
Not Rod Gilbert. It wasn't Rod Gilbert. Sorry? Rod Gilbert's a comedian, isn't he?
It was LucasArts, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was it LucasArts?
Yeah, I think it was Rod without an H.
Oh, right, okay. I thought, because Sierra were doing a lot of point-and-click stuff as well with King's
Quest. They were, but they sort of paved the way with, like, King's Quest and Leisure Suit Larry and stuff.
Yeah.
But the absolute pinnacle were the stuff like that came sort of early 90s, which was your the Monkey Island trilogy.
Yeah.
You had Lord of the Temptress from Virgin.
Oh, yeah, that was an amazing game.
Beneath a Steel Sky.
Oh, which yes.
Which speech as well if you got the CD32 version.
They were like the first-person shooters of their day, though, weren't they? They were sort of the big games.
Beneath the Steel Sky.
They were like the closest you got to AAA titles.
Beneath the Steel Sky was an amazing game.
Yeah.
Because you know how everyone talks about cyberpunk video games and they talk about stuff like System Shock and then, you know, they talk about, Deus Ex and stuff like that. Beneath the Steel Sky was preceded them by a long way.
I'm going to make a bit of a leap here, but this connects to Ukulele. You know, whereas in Ukulele, it looks at nostalgia and thinks, you know, that's fine. Let's just repeat it, not really add anything.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. Point-and-click adventures, when they were a thing, when they were the AAA titles of their day, you were pushing the boundaries of what could be done. Suddenly, there was a reason to have a mouse attached to your computer for your games.
Yeah.
But now, I think for a long time, the point and click was basically dead or dying.
Yeah, because and... we've moved on to big open world adventures like Fallout and Mass Effect and things like that.
I mean, I'm not going to say Memoranda is one of the best examples. It's an entertaining example and really likable example, but it's also, it's taking that old genre and doing it in different ways and telling different stories. And even in the case of Telltale, I know they're flawed and they're very repetitive, but it is pushing the genre forward in interesting ways. Yeah. I like that, you know, it's that sort of stuff which keeps games interesting.
Well, I think with the Telltale stuff, they've sort of married up the point and click genre with the sort of quick time event approach as well, haven't they?
Yeah. I think that's been one of the genius things they've done. Just touching on what you said about Fallout, I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of Fallout 3 and 4. I still prefer, even now to this day, the original two Fallout games to the more modern additions to the franchise.
Well, you've heard me speak on 4Panel about my dry patch with comics.
Yeah.
About the same time, I had a dry patch on gaming.
Ah.
So I basically went from Amiga gaming to Xbox 360.
The big dry patch.
Yeah.
Everything will be amazing then.
Yes. There was a brief 6-month dalliance with a Dreamcast, but we weren't happy together.
See, nobody was happy with the Dreamcast at first, but then you realised it was the one you wanted all along. But it was too late. You were in a steady relationship with another console and you could no longer go back to the dream that you had.
The thing with the Dreamcast was it took me a while to get used to it, and I got some very obscure game titles came my way, like Tokyo Bus Simulator.
Oh, yes.
Which I never got.
One second late and you lose the game, you fail.
It was worse than that. It was, if you forgot to indicate that you'd looked in your wing mirror before pulling out, you failed.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is, right, do you still have Tokyo Bus Simulator?
No.
Because if you had it, you'd be sitting on a small fortune.
Almost certainly. Although I would suggest that, bearing in mind, I got it from a friend and it wasn't in what you might call official packaging.
Ah, okay. Well, if you had it still, I would have had it off you. But it's one of the few Dreamcast games I haven't played.
Yeah.
To return to Memoranda, I love that point and clicks are returning. I just love it.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things where some of the retro games people or the retro genre, some of them are there because people won't let them die.
Hmm.
They themselves are stuck in a, which is why they've become a bit niche, because there's like 20 people who still want to play Monkey Island because they didn't play it when it was a thing. But I think if they are doing something new and also dealing with new subject material, then I think there's a place for it. And they are quite enjoyable. In fact, while we've been discussing this, I've called up Steam and I've looked at the price of Memoranda and I might give it a go.
I mean, I tried to give a donut to a dog, but the dog wasn't interested. So, I think that's the only sentence you could talk about when it comes to point and click.
Yeah. Attach rubber chicken to pulley. One of the best phrases in gaming.
So another wild diversion takes us from nice sort of point and click to whatever Fortnite is.
Ah, I'm glad you ask. We've been talking quite a bit about... genres not doing anything new. But this one kind of takes the best bits of several genres and game styles. So what I'm going to describe to you, imagine if, and Rob, you might want to cover your ears given what you've just said about Fallout. But if you imagine the guys who wrote the script for Borderlands joined forces with the guys who did the artwork for Overwatch.
Okay.
And they did the construction element of Fallout 4.
Okay.
Wrapped it up in a survival horror story.
Yeah.
That's basically what Fortnite is. It's kind of a tower defense scenario, but with that cartoony style from Overwatch, that irreverent humor from Borderlands. And basically, the background is that there's an apocalyptic storm cloud covering the Earth. which has caused armies of the undead of various different grades to start attacking. There are pockets of survivors around who you have to rescue. And basically, you've got to try and find tech that will combat the storm. When you find it and activate it, you've then got to defend it against the hordes of zombies that start to attack it. You can build up your combat strengths and your defense capabilities by training up and leveling up the survivors and forming them into sort of fire defense teams, EMT units, etc. You can recruit heroes to your cause, and then you can go online, and it's a multiplayer, four-person, co-op, Defend the Tower experience. And it's really quite addictive. I loaded it up last night, the idea being that at the very least I'd have a first impressions of the first 20 minutes. And 3.5 hours later...
That's the sign of a good game.
Yeah. It's not my... And the thing is, it's not my kind of game. I'd seen it advertised on the Xbox One and thought, no, not giving that a try. I'm not going to pre-order that. I'm not going to register for the open beta. And then, obviously, I got the review codes and thought, well, I'll give it a go. Now, my laptop isn't a gaming laptop.
Yeah.
So the recommended settings within the game for my laptop are medium at best for the graphics and the sound. And it looks gorgeous. It sounds brilliant. So I can only guess at what it's like on a full-spec gaming rig. I was playing it at a consistent 30 frames per second. The action is really smooth. And bear in mind that I've never really done keyboard and mouse action games.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat advanced in years and find it difficult to remember all the keyboard shortcuts and controlling the mouse at the same time whilst not making my character look up in the sky or meditate on his shoelaces. But I found it really intuitive using the keyboard, helped not to a small amount by the fact that it displays the keys you need to press to do certain things almost constantly, without being intrusive. The other aspect of it is, as an Xbox One owner, I also have a controller. And because the Xbox One is a Windows 10 device, you can use your controller on the laptop. So I did that, and it wasn't actually that much of a chore switching from controller to keyboard and mouse and back.
That's
so
really
it's,
good.
It's a very intuitive interface.
That is really good.
Yeah.
And cross-platform, it's coming out for Mac, PC, PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. It's cross-playable between PC and PlayStation 4 on the multiplayer. It's not cross-playable on the Xbox with other formats because, for some reason, Microsoft just refused to do that.
Which still doesn't make any sense.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I can kind of see why they wouldn't want it cross-playable with the PlayStation. I can kind of see why they maybe wouldn't want to make it cross-playable with the Mac, but with the advent of Play Anywhere titles, it would seem to me to be a no-brainer to make even at least the Play Anywhere titles cross-playable.
Well, I mean,
between PC and Xbox.
The reason why I say it doesn't make sense is if you've got if it's cross-playable between a PC and a PS4 and a PC and a Mac, as you said, an Xbox One is a Windows 10 device.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying it doesn't make sense if it's fine for a PC, but. Yeah.
I can kind of see why they wouldn't want it cross-playable with the PS4 and the Mac.
This is something that was weird because was it Rocket League or Minecraft, which has just had the whole controversy where it's cross-playable with PC, Mac, Xbox and the Switch, and it was Sony that was kicking up the fuss saying that they wouldn't want a cross-play with Xbox.
Possibly.
So it kind of seems weird that this is like kind of on the other foot where it's Microsoft spitting the dummy out.
Well, Microsoft have regularly been asked the question, will you make certain titles cross-playable? And they've always said no. Now, whether they're just putting out a point-blank no because they know Sony will spit their dummy out the pram, I don't know. But it seems odd that it's Microsoft that's not cross-playable with PC.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems weird.
That one really doesn't make sense.
That one really doesn't make sense. So, there's there's a lot of team building, progression. There's RPG elements. There's fortress building. There's strategy elements. You can place traps on the ground and the walls of the constructions you build. And it's just really, really good fun.
One of the trailers I saw for Fortnite said there was tons of loot.
There are tons of loot. This is an indication of how much loot there is. And the way that the loot gets delivered to you varies as well. So some of the loot gets delivered to you in the form of a loot chest.
Okay.
Now, at the end of each mission, you get a loot chest. And you see a row of loot chests, and it determines which level loot chest you've acquired, and you get to open them. And then you get bonus loot, which is delivered in the form of a piñata llama, which you can tickle and which talks.
Tickle the piñata.
Tickle the piñata. You can tickle the piñata, and the piñata will react accordingly with some kind of pithy remark. There's some really nice robot characters that are sort of your support team that give you your mission and objectives, etc. And it's just really nice. And then you get to develop your weapons. You can upgrade weapons. You can upgrade the building materials. You have to go out and smash pretty much anything you can see to get materials to build your defenses with. So you're smashing up cars that are abandoned in the street, smashing up houses and decorations, etc. And obviously certain types of scenery give you certain amounts of certain types of resource. You can, when you're constructing a defense around a device that you need to protect, you can choose to build it out of wood, metal, or stone, depending on what resources you've got available. So it's really in depth. You can upgrade all your heroes and your survivors to build your team's strength up. Is there anything I've missed? I've mentioned piñatas, yeah?
Yep.
In terms of now the version I've been playing is the deluxe edition. Because I'm playing the deluxe edition, I don't get any visibility of what the difference is with the basic edition. But what I can tell you is that Fortnite is by Epic Games and is therefore based on the Unreal Engine. So, you know, it's a fairly mature platform now, the Unreal Engine. So you don't get much in the way of odd little glitches. It's currently in closed beta. So unless you've been given a code or invited into a code, you can't play just yet, but there is early access for anyone who's pre-ordered or pre-registered for the open beta. That's coming in the next week or so, and it comes to all four formats real soon.
Yes, yes, it does.
The other thing is, the reason you've got this review is because the NDA got lifted yesterday, so I timed that nicely.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Ah, right, so finishing with me, are we?
Yes.
And I'm heading back to Musou territory. Technically, the Musou games do have plenty of loot as well. Doesn't sound like anywhere near as much as Fortnite has. But you're probably thinking, hang on, there isn't a Dynasty Warriors or a Samurai Warriors game that was out recently. Well, there was. Not too long ago, Samurai Warriors Spirit of Sanada was released. And I will be honest, it's a hell of a game. Now,
you can, just before you get into it,
yeah,
I think these games have to really work hard, because if you've not played Dynasty Warriors, I think they're all basically using the same version of Dynasty Warriors 10 was the most recent one.
Yeah.
And they're basically all just skins, aren't they?
No. See, this is the thing. That's why I said this is a surprisingly good game. You might look at this and go, Samurai Warriors, I played loads of Samurai Warriors games. I know what to expect. Dynasty Warriors, I played loads of Dynasty Warriors games. I know what to expect. You don't. Not when you're approaching this game. On the surface, it looks like exactly the same sort of games as those games. But, you know, that's only skin deep. It's the same as those games in the way that Berserk and the Band of the Hawk was the same as Dynasty Warriors. Do you see what I mean? Because it's all about the story with this, in the same way that Berserk was all about the story. And that's where these deviate wildly from the Dynasty Warriors and the Samurai Warriors games. Now, this one focuses specifically on the Sanada clan during a specific period in Japanese history. And because it's referring to history, you all, if you read up on the Sanada clan, especially Sanada Masayuki and his son Sanada Yukimura, then you know how this game is going to end. And it
you're
does.
Not, you're not going to get into the history, are you? Because the history gets super complex.
No. I'm not getting into the history. All I was going to say was it doesn't end well for the Sanadas. Okay? There is no way to change that. This is the thing. There's no way to change that. There's no way to glorify it. So the question then becomes, can you do a full game based on just this one section of the Sanada clan's history?
But my point is,
when you've already referenced these bits in other games,
is it accessible though? Because, like I said, it's the stories are incredibly politically motivated, and it's about clans and families and territory.
And that's my point. That's why I'm getting to that. You're preempting me, Rob.
Old habits.
I was going to ask about accessibility actually, because one of the earliest games I got in my 360 days was one of the Dynasty Warriors titles, and not so much the story or the historical aspect of it, that was what attracted me to the game in the first place, but I found the mechanics and a sort of foreknowledge of how those games worked would have been essential.
See,
I kind of felt, and I gave it three or four different goals, setting aside an afternoon to try and get into it, but I found myself feeling like I needed to play Dynasty Warriors 1 and 2 to understand how the hell I was going to play Dynasty Warriors 3.
See, it's all changed since then, Mick. The whole thing has changed. It's a lot more simplified. These games, I could put somebody who's never played a Dynasty Warriors game. See, when you're talking about something like Berserk and the Band of the Hawk, it's actually more complicated than Spirit of Sanada in terms of its controls, in terms of how you play the game. But there are certain mechanics that are the same. The Spirit of Sanada has a fort area where you can go around, you can upgrade your weapon, you can talk to other people, that sort of thing. Berserk and the Band of the Hawk has exactly the same sort of thing. You have like a castle area where you can do that. It's a bit like the current Tokiden game where you have like this base area where you can do various things and pick up like little quests.
Sort of like the hub area.
Yeah, like a hub area. And then you go out and then it goes to the map of that region, and you can explore the region and basically fight off soldiers and pick up little bits here and there, maybe save a few people, fight off some animals maybe every now and then. It's a very straightforward hack and slash game during those periods. When you get to the actual combat missions, those missions play out in the same way that they do with the Dynasty Warriors games and the Samurai Warriors games, where you have these goals. But one of the differences here is that within those missions, you actually have certain strategies, which then lead on to strategies that can become active in later missions. So you could actually change the nature of later missions by completing or failing certain strategies in the current mission.
Well, just to compare it to what it used to be, because that's changed immensely. I've played quite a lot of them since, like, Dynasty Warriors 9.
Yeah.
And structurally, it's like, you're a big, powerful guy. Go over there. Beat all those people up. Oh, you got here. Oh, you got to go over there. Go over there and beat all those people up.
Well,
and it's just, like, the introduction of strategy is a bit of a game changer.
Yeah, but this is my point. That, I think, is specific to Spirit of Sanada. I don't know if that can be applied to other games in the Musou franchise. I think Spirit of Sanada had to have that hook, because otherwise it would just be the same as the other games. And the thing is, the big draw here is literally that you have the ability to play as Sanada Masayuki and his son, Sanada Yukimura. And just a little bit of history, because he's like really important in terms of Japanese history, Sanada Yukimura is. He was called a hero who may appear once in 100 years, Crimson Demon of War, the last Sengoku hero, and the veteran from the invasion of Korea, Shimazu Tadatsune, called him the number one warrior in Japan. And one of the big changes here is, you're not just playing a Musou game. you're actually playing a game where you actually Sanada Masayuki, and then you basically go through the process of raising the young Sanada Yukimura, and then you take on the role of Sanada Yukimura.
Hmm.
Do you see? And that is a big change. So you're basically playing through the later life of one character and then the life of the other character up until his death. And some people might find that kind of boring in terms of the story, but I'll be honest, I thought it was really good.
It needed that change. I mean, I think there was a little bit. I mean, the setting that he started putting focus on the story in the second Dragon Quest Heroes 2.
Dragon Quest.
Yeah. Because the story in that was much more prominent than it had been in any other games that I've played before that.
It was the same with Berserk and the Band of the Hawk. The story is the thing that keeps you there. It's what makes you play through the missions. And the missions are basically go there, kill that big guy, go there, kill that big guy, go there, save that, go there, destroy that catapult. But you play through those missions just to progress the story because the story is that good. And this is one of those situations where I was really surprised at how engaging the story actually is. You're willing to go through and do all these missions. And they've upgraded kind of the dialogue as well, so that you have these pithy little comments flying around when you meet up with one of your retainers or one of your fellow warriors, and you just save their life and they throw a little comment your way. And you just kind of, that's a good little pun, or that's a good quip. And then you just go off and start killing more soldiers. And yes, that action is repetitive, but the controls are so simple, you know, that it takes a while for it to feel boring. And at that point, you can just basically go, right, putting this down, I'm going to go do something else for a while, leave the game for a couple of days, come back when you feel like it, and pick it up again.
Yeah, the missions are quite succinct and to the point as well, so it has that dip-in, dip-out aspect down to a trait.
One of the early missions, is from the first kind of multi-stage mission that you do, right, you have these strategies at the side. One of the strategies was, because it's going to be a foggy night, you need to guide your troops, so you need to light torches to show your troops the way through the forest, right? And if you don't do that, then you can't make it to the enemy fort before dawn. And if you can't do that, then that closes off an entire series of strategies that can affect the missions later on.
It's pretty cool.
You see?
I mean, if you said this of any Dynasty Warriors style game 5 years ago, you'd have been laughed out the building.
Yeah, exactly.
It was just basically stress relief for Japanese salarymen.
Yeah. One of the other nice things in this as well is the importance of standard bearers. They've really raised the importance of standard bearers in this, because you don't really see standard bearers that often in the other Dynasty Warriors games. But in this, when you're attacking like a fort, if you kill off the standard bearer, you know, the flag waver, wherever he is, the banner man, if you kill him off, you drop the morale of the troops and half them run away, which makes the game easier.
That's cool. I must admit, how is it like compared to other like Musou titles? Because I mean, I know from like past experience, I've clocked up like hundreds of hours on like both the Hyrule Warriors ones and the Dynasty Warriors and the One Piece ones as well. So how is it like that? Is it more story oriented? Does it lose a bit of that replayability?
Well, I think I'm coming at it from the right angle. See, if you look at the games that I've played recently, I absolutely adored Nobunaga's Ambition, which is also by Koei Tecmo. And recently I reviewed Romance of the Three Kingdoms 13, which, again, I absolutely adore, and I'm still playing. And because I've played those two games, I think that that's put me in the right mindset to play Spirit of Sanada.
Yeah.
Because I think if you were going to approach it just as a normal Dynasty Warriors game, not only that, because I reviewed Berserk as well, Berserk and the Band of the Hawk, which is very different to your usual Dynasty Warriors, Samurai Warriors type game. And because of those factors, I think my mindset has been just right to actually play this game and appreciate it maybe a little bit more than if I'd never played those games.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's a prerequisite to play those games. I think that if you just approach this game cold and just keep an open mind, you might be surprised at how engaging the game is and how engaging the characters are.
Uh-huh. I'm just thinking more because obviously nearly all other Musou games, you can get like hundreds of hours out of them. Can you do that with this?
Easy.
Oh, that's good.
Now, let's put it this way. As with any Musou game, right? You might, you know, it might seem like you're paying through the nose for it, but in terms of how long you'll be playing it, you know, you're getting your money's worth.
Yeah, you can always get like 50 to 100 hours at least off a Musou Gear.
Yeah, easy. But yeah, Samurai Warriors, Spirit of Sanada. I'm very surprised at how good a game it is. And even though it keeps the things that make it a Musou game, all of the elements that make it a Musou game are there. They're there on full display. But it doesn't feel like you're playing a Musou game. And that's because of the story and the characters.
Oh, I mean, looking into a scene, picking it up.
Also, if you like your history, then play the game.
Yeah, I'm kind of fancying a new Musou game to tide us over until Fire Emblem drops in the later on in the year, and it's like, which one do I go for? So I might pick this one up since it seems a bit more story orientated.
Well, not only by the end of playing this, you'll know most of what happened during that particular period of Japanese history. I think it was the Tokugawa Shogunate, was it? No, during that Sengoku period. Anyway. And that will make you a hit at any anime and manga convention because you can talk about it.
Oh, God, I'm getting prison screen flashbacks now.
You can talk about it to all the weebs. And you can say, well, during my studies of the Sengoku period, you don't need to tell them that it was just you playing a Musou game.
That's interesting, though, because historical games used to be a bit of a dirty word.
Yeah, but they're really coming into their own again. I think if it wasn't like World War One or World War Two or, you know, ancient Rome or ancient Greece or some kind of weird made-up version of the medieval period, that didn't actually happen, but, you know.
Yeah, Victorian England wasn't really like Bloodborne. They made it up.
But this is the thing. If it's not one of those periods, it doesn't get looked at that often.
Yeah. Well, I'd say solid week of games, I think. So I had First Strike Final Hour. I forgot the name. I have to look it up again. And Memoranda.
Considering the word memory is part of one of the names of the games you've done.
What other titles have we had this week?
Fortnite.
Ukulele. Or Banjo-Kazooie 3, or whichever way you want to call it.
And I had Guilty Gear Xrd Rev 2 and Samurai Warriors Spirit of Sanada, both of which are available now.
Yes. Good week of good games. So this has been Press X. We'll be back with more. But if you did like this, share it with your friends. Give us a rating on iTunes. Subscribe. Whatever way you interact with podcasts, do it with us. We'll like you for it. If you want to interact with us in any other ways, we've got a variety of other podcasts. Just for the people that are on board today, you can listen to Keyframe, which is our anime and cartoons and animation podcast. Our Four Panel, which is our comic book and manga podcast.
And I'll have you know that both of them are probably the best.
You're saying that, not because of the quality of the show, but by the crappiness of the competition.
No. I think you'll find, Rob, that certainly Four Panel is the pinnacle of comic reviewdom.
Yeah. We do comic book journalism like nobody else does.
I'll allow it.
But yeah, it's the truth.
Say that like it's a good thing.
It's the absolute. Mick, did I say any lies in what I said?
No.
I'm okay with that anyway. But yeah, we have been Press X. I have been Rob.
I've been Mick.
I've been Mark.
And I've been Rob.
Thanks for listening.